and a dramatic reimagining of his life.
I sense a streak of radical mischief in Dr. Vaughan Williams.
Ralph Vaughan Williams, his passions, influences and friendships, and revel in his glorious music on the 150th anniversary of his birth. All weekend on Radio 3 and on BBC Sounds.
It's midday, time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the writer and theatre critic Arifa Akbar.
Arifa Akbar almost never has a quiet night in. As chief theatre critic of The Guardian, she's out reviewing a production almost every evening, and when she's not doing that, she's sitting on the boards of the Orwell Foundation and English Pen, or judging prizes like the Costa Biography Award, the UK Theatre Awards, and the Women's Prize for Fiction. Last year, she published a highly praised memoir, Consumed, In Search of My Sister, about the death of her older sister, Fauzia, from tuberculosis. Arifa, I want, obviously, to talk to you about that book and about your sister's deeply moving story. But first, the sheer relentlessness of your job. You're usually writing, as I said, 5 or 6 reviews a week for The Guardian. Do you ever crave a quiet evening and an early night? Or do you look forward to every night at the theatre?
Well, both of those things. I crave a night in, and I sometimes get a night in. I get really excited about going to the theatre too. I get very excited about the build-up. So it's both those things. It's a night job. It's dawned on me gradually that I would be starting my day when most people were finishing it, often leaving my flat, you know, when it was turning dark, and spilling out of the theatre 11 o'clock and going home, and the thrill of putting that review together overnight and sending it off by early morning.
You don't pull your punches in your reviews. I won't name the production, but you recently gave just 1 star to what you described as a hideously misguided workplace sex comedy ruined by odious vulgarity. How do you feel about giving bad reviews?
I feel awful. I'm one of those reviewers who finds writing a positive review easier and quicker and simply just more joyous. I have more to say. I find 1-star reviews are incredibly rare for me. So I really mean it when I give a 1-star.
I suppose it is important, though, to have that contrast, because after all, one's got to remember some people will be buying tickets on your say-so.
This is what I keep foremost in my mind, that I'm writing for readers who may well book a ticket on my recommendation, and they're who I have in mind rather than the theatre industry, because I'm not part of the theatre industry. I'm a newspaper woman.
We're going to hear music today from Puccini, Verdi, Philip Glass, and soundtracks from the Bollywood films of your childhood. But first, music closely bound up with the theatre. So tell me a little bit about the composers and the sound designers, Ben and Max Ringham, and what they bring to productions.
They come from a very, you know, electronic, drum and bass was their first love, an electronic background. Yet a lot of their sound and composition, it sounds, you know, incredibly orchestral, very beautiful, layered, complicated as any sort of piece of classical music. And I was intrigued that siblings should compose together. How would you do that? So I began consciously sort of going to productions and listening out for their sounds, and it's always memorable.
Well, we're going to hear I Went Outside Into the Sun from a sound installation called Blindness, which was staged at the Donmar Warehouse in the summer of 2020. And of course, this was during the COVID pandemic.
After so long of not being allowed to enter a theatre, we entered all with our masks, sat socially distanced, put on binaural headphones. Blindness, the show, is an adaptation of the novel Blindness by the Nobel Prize winner Saramago, and I was so moved and struck by the power of it, because the sound was riveting, it was frightening, it was compelling, utterly captivating. There was layers of sound, it was haunting, it was absolutely wonderful to have that in the middle of this desert of theatre that the pandemic became.
I Went Outside into the Sun by Ben and Max Ringham, from their sound design to the installation Blindness, staged in London in 2020. And we're very grateful to the Ringham brothers for permission to play that recording. I couldn't help thinking as we were listening to it that there's such a narrow line between music and oral soundscapes, if you know what I mean, and especially for the theatre.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes they're indistinguishable. You know, I think the sound design is the composition. And the sound is so important. It can be as eloquent as the script. I find that again and again, the sound talks. It creates atmosphere, makes a scene.
You were born, Arifa Akbar, in London, but spent your very early childhood with your Pakistani family in Lahore. Do you have strong memories from then? I know you were quite young.
I was really young. I was 3 and returned at the age of 5. But those nearly 2 years are so vivid. They're like photographic snapshots. And I remember this childhood for those years just to be utterly glorious. So we were in an enormous extended family home, big gang of children with, you know, my 2 siblings, my older sister, my younger brother, but also the gang of cousins. So many of the sights and sounds remained vivid, utterly vivid, for decades after we returned to London and settled in London. And over the years, you know, I have wondered how reliable, how real those memories, those 2 vivid memories are, or whether I've sort of coloured them in.
We do actually have some music to conjure up that memory for you, because it's from the 1960 film The Great Mughal. Does it strike a chord with what you remember?
Mughal-e-Azam was the seminal sort of Bollywood film made in 1960 and with Nashod Ali, who combined popular, you know, Bollywood sounds and music with classical Indian strains of ragas and geets. And it features the story of, you know, Prince Salim's love for a lowly court dancer called Anarkali. It's a love story with, you know, a sad love story. I'm not a fan of Bollywood films. We didn't grow up with much Bollywood music or film in our lives. But this is a really extraordinary film. It was made in black and white and later coloured in, with only certain scenes were coloured in. And they have this psychedelic, too bright look, a little bit like my childhood memories. And this film blew me away. And some of the songs are just extraordinary. This combination of the classical sounds of Indian music with the Bollywood sound.
Why Fear When in Love? Lata Mangeshkar, who died earlier this year, in music from the soundtrack to the 1960 film The Great Mughal, composed by Naushad Ali. Arifa, when you were five, your family returned to London. It must have been a huge contrast to your life in Lahore.
Immense, and it leached all that colour that I was talking about out of my life. And the trauma of leaving this gorgeous house filled with colour and warmth and family, ending up in London homeless. My parents had no idea of social housing, and we ended up living in a disused home, a squat essentially, in one room, in the middle of Hampstead in North London, which in an immensely, even in the late 1970s, it was filled with immense wealth and privilege. And there we were, like mice really, in hiding in this dilapidated building, which still stands there, by the way. It's been refurbished and it's very smart, like all the other homes in Hampstead. And we lived in this one damp, soggy walled room. And it really, it sounds like something out of the Victorian age. We had a tap that dripped brown water that my mother would boil up before doing everything that water requires, from cooking to cleaning to washing our uniforms. We were going to the local primary school, and so was my sister. We lived this furtive life for the first nearly year of our lives, until Camden Council found us and housed us, and we got a little council house in Primrose Hill in North London.
Well, why did your family decide to make the transition, given, as you've said, it was like going from colour to black and white?
They were desperate to stay in Pakistan, but the family house sort of teemed with tensions. My father's brothers were running businesses and they were successful, and my father wasn't able to find a place in Lahore, you know, and work in Lahore and progress any sort of business or career. And the tensions in the house meant that really, you know, he wasn't bringing anything to the house, and they decided perhaps they'd try again in London for a second time. They didn't want to. Their hearts, I think their home was Lahore. They left reluctantly, and I think we as children picked up on that sadness. So they left with heavy hearts, and I came without a word of English at the age of five, not a word. So my first few years were filled with silence. I had no language, and we had very little, you know, very few possessions in that little flat we were given in North London. We only had a bed. My parents slept on the floor for the first year. And gradually we got a sound system and we got four LPs. I remember just four. And I would sit by the record player and, you know, listen to these LPs over and over. And they were Indian music, you know, a lot of it sort of classical Bollywood music. And I would enter another world. And I think the reason why I felt so exhilarated and comforted by them is because they were really my only link, our only link to the world we'd lost, the world we'd left behind, the sounds of that wonderful family home. I still have this LP from over 40 years ago. It's a childlike thing because you hear the bansuri. I don't even know what it is in English, actually. It's a kind of flute. The bean music is traditional music for hypnotizing snakes, you know, on the streets of Lahore, the street musicians, and we heard them play bansuris. So I absolutely love it.
Music composed by Hemant Kumar for the 1954 film Nagin. The vocalist, once again, of course, the legendary Lata Mangeshkar. And you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Arifa Akbar, if you visit the Private Passions webpage. And also, if you visit BBC Sounds, you can enjoy hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Arifa, theatre has clearly been a passion for you for decades, but I think opera left you cold until you started exploring it after the death of your sister Fawzia from tuberculosis in 2016. And I think you became fascinated by, but also repelled by, operas which seem to glamorise women dying of TB, of which, of course, there are several, aren't there?
After my sister died, well, as she was dying, actually, a doctor came in. He was, I think, he couldn't quite express any feeling. And so he began to talk about deaths in opera, in 19th century opera. And he said, oh, well, there have been some grand deaths, you know, tubercular deaths in 19th century. And he was talking about Verdi and Puccini. And I found it really distasteful. And I left that memory. I sort of tucked it away. I think I deliberately forgot about it. And after the doctor had mentioned, you know, operas and tubercular women by my sister's bedside, a peculiar lost memory surfaced again. So I bought tickets for my sister's 18th birthday, two tickets to the Royal Opera House to see La Bohème, which was two decades before she became ill with TB. Now, I think back to that moment and I think, why did I want to get her tickets to see a Puccini opera? Neither of us had, as far as I remember, any interest in opera. And yet, I bought her these tickets, and there was my sister at the age of 18, watching a woman die of tuberculosis, which she would die of at the age of 45.
I think you made a special trip to Italy to see Angela Georgiou singing La Bohème, didn't you?
When I began reading up on some of the historic sort of mysteries and mythologies around tuberculosis, some of these mythologies tied artistic sensibilities to the illness. It was supposed to heighten sexual appetite. It's supposed to heighten feelings of love and make you more artistic. And the more I looked, the more appalled I became. And alongside that, the more captivating I found these operas to be, and I was really conflicted. So I decided to go and see this opera, and I was desperate to see it as quickly as possible. The closest place where I could find a staging was weirdly in Puccini's hometown in Torre del Lago in Tuscany. And the only night that I could go was on my birthday, on the 4th of August. I mean, how odd is that? And so off I went. And it was breathtaking. And I saw this glorious, glorious opera as the sun went down, with birds flying across the stage. And the final scene in which Mimi sings to Rodolfo, where they come together and they remember how they met. It was so moving, and she was in a bed that was very like the hospital bed in which my sister died, and it took me straight back there. And the moment when she dies, the entire auditorium went black, and there was this terrible silence, and it was such an overwhelming moment. But I find this, the aria, so, so moving, because the lovers are together again. She sort of sums up so much about the tubercular woman in these 19th century operas, the emotional pitch of that final song. It was the best way to see, and the most devastating way to see this opera, and I was so glad I went.
Angela Gheorghiu and Roberto Alagna in music from the final act of Puccini's La Bohème. Sono andati. Riccardo Chailly was conducting the orchestra of La Scala Milan. Arifa Akbar, your sister Fauzia's TB was undiagnosed until the day before her death, despite the fact that she'd been cared for in a major London teaching hospital for a long time. Why did so many doctors fail to diagnose her?
Well, that's the sort of $64 million question. I have no idea. They simply didn't think of it. And this is the thing with tuberculosis. It's entirely curable with a course of antibiotics, actually, if a medical team suspects it might be TB. And there are forms of TB, some fairly, you know, more straightforward in diagnosing and some which are harder. My sister had a TB that became disseminated, sort of spread around her body. And we were told that it became tricky to diagnose because it sort of mimics other things. So the team was, you know, running around in circles, essentially, going down all sorts of avenues and not being able to diagnose what was going on, what was going so wrong. There was a review after her death. She had a massive brain hemorrhage, and only after that brain hemorrhage, we were told she would never recover, but only after that hemorrhage did the doctors, you know, finally thought that it could be TB and realised it was. In the review after her death, they admitted to missed opportunities to diagnose, and we were thunderstruck.
I mean, Fauzia's history is indeed a tragic one, and I can't help asking you whether you feel that her poor mental health, her eating disorder, the fact she came from an ethnic minority, perhaps contributed to the failure of doctors to diagnose.
In this case of my sister, you're absolutely right. We're aware of the fact that it's a now an illness that affects the marginalised, the poor, the migrant communities, prison communities, people with mental health. And this is all the stuff that I learned that, yes, you're right, it was connected to my sister's lifelong depression and eating disorder. I feel great pain, you know, in thinking that she didn't know what was killing her. I think she knew, you know, whatever was ravaging her from inside was going to kill her. I think she knew that. But unlike the women in these operas, she had no idea what it was, you know.
I must say, having myself had renal TB, which is quite difficult to diagnose, I found it almost unbearable to read this story because once it is diagnosed, the drugs are there, streptomycin, inupazid, rifampicin. I mean, they exist and people should be cured nowadays.
Absolutely. It's a painful thing to know that my sister died of an illness that we cure. We cure all the time.
Well, we're going to hear music now from another opera with a dying tubercular heroine. This time, Verdi's La Traviata.
There are so many ripples of tragedies there. And that Verdi opera is actually based on Alexandre Dumas-Fil's novel, A Lady of the Camellias, which in itself is based on Marie Duplessis, who a real-life, you know, 19th century courtesan, who lived a high life as a courtesan and died destitute in Paris of tuberculosis at an incredibly young age. I found it incredibly uncomfortable. And I went to La Traviata and it filled me with unease. And yet I was sort of, I was won over by the beauty of the music.
Maybe that's why you've chosen the almost exhilarating pyrotechnics of the first act aria, Sempre Libera.
This track comes right after the very well-known sort of toast, doesn't it? The joy and hedonism and the sort of collective sound of that. And this brings us back to Violetta. And in her interiority, and there she is, a high-class courtesan. She's utterly in control. And then suddenly, a man enters her life, Alfredo, and she has fallen, you know, dramatically, instantly in love. She's questioning, you know, should she wants to stay free. She needs to be free so she can do her job, but she's in two minds. You know, she feels a headiness, a joy that, you know, sort of bowls her over. And it's such a beautiful moment of interiority and wrestling with her feelings. It captivated me.
Joan Sutherland as Violetta in that aria from the first act of La Traviata by Verdi. Francesco Molinari Pratelli was conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House. Arifa Akbar, sibling relationships are often the longest of our lives, but do you think we sometimes underestimate the power that they have over us?
Yes, I do think we underestimate them, and they just don't feature in art and literature as much as they should, because they're incredibly complicated and interesting. And, you know, when we do, I think, see sibling relationships, and particularly sisters, we see the sort of positive sisterly Little Women style relationships, or even, you know, the Van Gogh brothers, that sort of sacrifice and devotion. And we don't see the darker, spikier side. And I wanted to really understand my difficult, often very close, but very difficult relationship with my sister, and describe it in all honesty and without sugared sentimentality or sort of saccharine, and actually remind myself that it contains no less love and no less power just because it's dark and edgy and complicated, as my relationship, you know, with my sister was. And we were sometimes the best of friends, and we were sometimes sort of verging on enemies. And one of the things in writing the book, and one of the surprises, I think, is that people have got in touch, both men and women, to say, my brother or my sister has died or is alive, and I have an incredibly close relationship, or I have a very difficult relationship with my brother or sister. That's been a surprise, because I thought I was writing a book about my sister, her life and death, our shared love of art, and seeing the world through culture and understanding ourselves and the world through art and culture. But actually, I was writing, you know, a book also about that incredibly deep and difficult sometimes bond between siblings.
We're going to make quite a radical shift of gear in your exploration of opera now, because Philip Glass's 1979 Satyagraha about the early life of Gandhi in South Africa is your next choice. Now, this is very different, isn't it, from 19th century operas we heard earlier, all those Verdi fireworks, replaced with something more simpler, more meditative, more repetitive. What drew you to it?
I saw this opera, sort of over a decade ago at the Royal Opera House. It was one of the operas that I fell in love with first. I think it was the opera that made me see how I could connect with this musical form. I have a complicated feelings towards Gandhi, you know, particularly his view of caste. But, you know, he's a complicated and sort of somewhat problematic figure, as well as being a heroic figure. But I saw this and I felt so roused, particularly, you know, in this last act. I felt it was the repetitions of the notes were, I think, put me in a sort of hypnotic spell. You know, I grew up as a practicing Muslim. And what was interesting is that I sort of fell in love with devotional music, you know, not just the qawwalis that my parents grew up listening to, but, you know, Indian classical ragas and geets and Ravi Shankar's music. I didn't know when I watched Satyagraha and when I listened to it that Philip Glass had worked with Ravi Shankar, but I heard those sounds in the opera, and the same sort of meditative quality that I felt when I listened to devotional music, I heard here in this sound. And I suppose I've chosen this one, you know, for its otherworldly beauty and because it was the first opera that made me see all those things in the music.
Music from Evening Song, the finale of Satyagraha by Philip Glass, with Christopher Keane conducting the New York City Opera Chorus and Orchestra. Arifa, it's often been said, especially over recent years, that serious theatre is dying out, that London in particular is being taken over by musical. I wonder what your view is of the state of theatre in Britain.
We shouldn't be snooty about musicals, because when a musical is done well and inventively and excitingly, then it's as good as any play, as any drama. But yes, it does exasperate me. It's not just musicals, you know, it's those plays that the repetition of the comforting plays that I think we could now do without. And we can, you know, I think theatre is just at its best when it's pushing our buttons, you know, when it's forcing us into some level of discomfort, actually, and challenging our perceptions. You know, there's nothing stronger than walking out of a theatre riled or ruffled and playing that those ideas that have discomforted you, playing in your mind, not letting go.
But there is also a commercial dichotomy in a way, isn't there? Because the theatre is beyond the reach of many people, especially in London.
This is one of the things I am absolutely outraged by. You know, I grew up without very much money. And thankfully, you know, I went to North London School, who took us to theatre. And I also grew up in a time where theatre tickets weren't extortionate. You know, I have been disgusted by, I get to sit in the stalls in seats which are priced way beyond the type of money that I think, you know, I would pay to go to a theatre. Last year, there were news stories about some theatre tickets being priced £300 or £400. That's an outrage. And of course, you know, if we're talking about inclusivity, diversity, bringing in new types of people and younger people into the theatre, what on earth is commercial theatre doing by pricing tickets like this? I realise it's a business. I realise we've come out of a series of lockdowns and that there have been great losses in the theatre. But I don't think the way to reclaim those losses is to exclude the majority of people.
Have you ever been tempted to enter the world of theatre rather than simply write about it? Could you see yourself as a playwright or a director?
No way. No, I don't I wouldn't dare write a play. Partly because I'd be torn apart because I'm a theatre critic. I didn't think I could write a book before I'd written a book, though. So who knows? Maybe in time to come.
Well, I'll leave that thought to mull in your mind. As we listen to your final piece of music, a beautiful Gregorian chant. It feels a million miles away from late nights in the theatre and adrenaline-fueled deadlines. So when might you listen to this?
Exactly then, as you say, you know, in those adrenaline-fueled deadlines, those overnight reviews, when I come back home, you know, full of this, full of words sort of spilling out of me and thoughts, and I need to somehow calm myself, get in a space where I can work and type out, you know, the review. And the soundtrack to that is often the Gregorian chants, because it soothes and calms and takes me to a sort of place of, I suppose, real reflection and meditation, and a place of truth, actually, as pretentious as that sounds. And I need to write coherently in the middle of the night. And this music helps me.
Well, to which I can only say alleluia. And thank you very much, Arifa Akbar.
Thank you. It's been delightful. Wonderful.
The Benedictine monks of the Abbey of Santo Domingo de Silos. Closing that episode of Private Passions today, Michael Barclay was joined by Arifa Akbar. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. You can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. And there are hundreds of previous editions available to download too. The programme returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael's guest will be the artist, William Kentridge. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has insisted that Liz Truss remains in charge of the government and has urged his fellow Conservative MPs to rally behind the Prime Minister. He was speaking ahead of his meeting with her at Chequers today, after she sacked his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, and ditched two key measures from her tax-cutting plans. Ms Truss said this morning that the government was going to do things differently, charting a new course for growth, which she said remained the core mission. But Mr Hunt has already said nothing will be off the table when it comes to tax rises and public spending cuts. The Conservative MP Robert Halfen, who chairs the Commons Education Committee, has said the mini-budget had made ministers look like libertarian jihadists who were treating people like laboratory mice on which to carry out ultra-free market experiments. He said there needed to be a fundamental reset. China's leader Xi Jinping has stressed the need to prioritise economic development in an address to the Communist Party Congress in Beijing. However, he defended China's zero-COVID strategy and strict lockdowns, which have been blamed for an economic slowdown. He also said Beijing would not renounce the right to use force in order to take control of the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers part of China. Mr Xi has not yet named a successor, and it's expected he'll stay on in power past the customary 10-year term. Officials in Iran say 4 detainees have been killed and more than 60 injured in a fire that broke out in a prison last night. Footage emerged on social media showing flames, explosions and gunfire. The authorities blamed rioting at the Evin jail, which houses hundreds of political prisoners, as well as demonstrators who have taken part in recent anti-government protests. People in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region say they're running out of food and medical supplies because of a government offensive against Tigrayan rebels. The hostilities have worsened a famine there. The head of the US Agency for International Development has called for the military assault to end to save civilian lives. Buckingham Palace says more than 1,000 teddy bears left by people as tributes to the Queen will be donated to the children's charity Barnardo's. Many mourners have been inspired by a sketch for the Platinum Jubilee celebrations this summer, which saw Paddington Bear having tea with the Queen. And the weather, a mainly sunny afternoon with some cloud thickening from the southwest later on and rain reaching the area by evening. Temperatures are between 11 and 17 Celsius. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
The Oxford Lieder Festival, live on BBC Radio 3's lunchtime concert.
Give to me the life I love, let the late go by.
Featuring current and former BBC New Generation artists. In 4 days of enrapturing music by Vaughan Williams and composers he's inspired.
Oh, no.